Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Use Rocket Mortgage for a transparent, trustworthy home loan process that's completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. President Obama gave his final speech to the nation last night in an expansive and emotional address from Chicago. He outlined what he sees as the greatest threats to democracy and asked the American people to keep fighting for what they believe in.
I do have one final ask of you as your president. The same thing I asked when you took a chance on me 8 years ago. I'm asking you to believe, not in my ability to bring about change, but in yours.
And asking sometimes in rather dire terms. Obama's 8 years were marked with challenges and achievements, wide support and deep opposition. This hour On Point, sizing up the 44th president of the United States, Barack Obama, and the message of his farewell address. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you judge this president's performance, his years, and what is the legacy Barack Obama leaves behind? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington, Jamelle Bouie, chief political correspondent for Slate. Jamelle, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom, for having me.
With us now from New York, Jonathan Chait, writer for New York Magazine, author of the new book, Audacity, How Barack Obama Defied His Critics and Created a Legacy That Will Prevail. We'll look at that. Jonathan Chait, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
And from Washington, Molly Hemingway joins us, senior editor at The Federalist. Molly, it's great to have you here. Thanks for being here today.
Great to be here with you.
Let's listen to Barack Obama's kind of warm welcome to the crowd there. It was at the McCormick Center in Chicago, not far from Grant Park, where he had his tumultuous triumph back in 2008. Here he is, wrapping up his presidency.
Tonight, it's my turn to say thanks. Whether we have seen eye to eye or rarely agreed at all, my conversations with you, the American people, in living rooms and in schools, at farms, on factory floors, at diners, and on distant military outposts. Those conversations are what have kept me honest and kept me inspired and kept me going. And every day I have learned from you. You made me a better president, and you made me a better man.
You made me a better president, and you made me a better man. That was the warm and fuzzy part. A lot of thanks right there. And there were warnings about democracy itself. Here's just a taste.
The work of democracy has always been hard. It's always been contentious. Sometimes it's been bloody. For every two steps forward, it often feels we take one step back.
Got a range of views of Barack Obama here today. Molly Hemingway writes that he's delusional about what his own legacy is. Jonathan Chait writes that he has created a legacy that will prevail. Jamelle Bouie, you were listening along with much of the country last night. What did you hear in the president's farewell address from Chicago, Jamelle?
I think I heard more or less what I expected. Obama's great rhetorical strength, perhaps, certainly his rhetorical style, is to focus very much on optimism, on going forward, on common aspiration and on unity, and that was very much in keeping. I think the problem is that we are entering a political moment where kind of the darker underbelly of American politics is ascendant, and I don't mean the Republicans. I mean Donald Trump in particular and kind of the forces Donald Trump harnessed to make his run, his successful run for the presidency. And so with that on the horizon, or not even really on the horizon, with that quickly approaching, I think Obama's call for unity, a sense of optimism, falls a little short. And I think it ignores the extent to which, while progress is certainly a theme of American life, entire lives are lived in the shadow of backlash, and that's important too.
Molly Hemingway, you've been watching Barack Obama, not so crazy about his legacy. Did you hear a defense of a legacy last night primarily, or did you hear in some ways an attack on Donald Trump and his politics?
I think it was more that President Obama wanted to explain his view of his legacy and to contextualize how it is possible that a country could vote for Donald Trump after 8 years of President Obama. The clip that you just played of him saying, you know, there's two steps forward, one step back. That's a nice visual imagery for him. It's his way of feeling better about the fact that, in fact, Americans are not altogether. They like Obama. They really like him as a person. Not altogether that pleased with how he governed for the last 8 years.
Jonathan Chait, you write that this was a full-throated call to political arms against the politics of not Donald Trump exactly, but what you describe as Trumpism. What do you mean, Jonathan?
Yeah, I thought it was actually a very dark speech and a departure from his usual optimistic themes, which he did mention, but in a passing as a way of getting to the need to defend the democratic tradition against the authoritarian style, which he analyzed in unusual detail without using Trump's name. He almost put together piece by piece all the elements of Trumpism and this style of politics, which is also sweeping through parts of Europe, of nationalism and populism, distrust of elites, distrust of outsiders, distrust of reason and facts and empiricism, and gave a pretty rousing defense of the Enlightenment tradition of liberal politics.
Here he was talking about, he said that, of course, politics is a battle of ideas, but and this is getting to a kind of post-fact world that he's talked about, but, said the president.
But without some common baseline of facts, without a willingness to admit new information and concede that your opponent might be making a fair point and that science and reason matter, then we're going to keep talking past each other, and will make common ground and compromise impossible.
Don't just need facts, he said. We need American values as much as we need military strength, maybe more.
Protecting our way of life, that's not just the job of our military. Democracy can buckle when it gives in to fear. So just as we, as citizens, must remain vigilant against external aggression, we must guard against a weakening of the values that make us who we are.
Jamelle Bouie, the balance of dark and light here. We heard the light at the outset of the speech there, and more again at the end. Jonathan Chait says a lot of warnings of darkness here as well.
Yeah, I guess I sort of sense that darkness, but I think because it's sort of bookended by that sense of optimism, you know, Obama clearly has a view that we can push through this, that democracy will be protected or it can be protected. And that's where I sort of take a much more reticent, like, well, who knows what's going to happen? Although I do agree with the president that there do seem to be these very profound threats toward democratic traditions. And one thing I do like about the speech is that Obama sort of asked the country to address this in part by doing more democracy. I think there's a real sense in which ordinary people feel alienated from self-governance, not necessarily in terms of the government's responsiveness to their problems, although that's there as well, but sort of in an everyday sense, that the sense that an ordinary worker, for example, has much control over their fate is greatly diminished from where it was a generation ago. And that kind of lowercase d democratic activity, I think, needs to be revitalized. And I think Obama is sort of pushing the message that it needs to be revitalized.
I mean, Jonathan Chait, we've often heard Barack Obama refer to Martin Luther King talking about how the long arc of history bends toward justice. And essentially, he's spread that faith toward democracy as well. But he did say last night, the gains of our long journey to freedom are not assured. I have never heard him open up that kind of crack of lack of confidence in his presentation, Jonathan, before.
No, that's absolutely right. And I think his analysis of American history is correct, that over the long run, things are better today than they were 50 years ago. And 50 years ago, they were better than they were 50 years before that. And that's the general pattern. And that's the pattern that he's always expected it to follow. But he departed from that, like you said, in a really unusual way. Now, he did it in a rousing and inspiring way, which is how you do it, right? When when Bill Pullman in Independence Day gives a speech, he doesn't say, these aliens are really powerful. They're probably going to kill
doomed.
Us. But let's hope that maybe somehow we can avoid that.
Say, let's go get them.
Right, exactly. That's kind of how you do it. And that's what he did. But the threat was pretty clearly implied in a rather stark and chilling way.
Molly, is Donald Trump part of the legacy of Barack Obama? He's going to succeed him.
He is. I want just really quickly this point you just made about how he left his language of how we're on the right side of history and other people are on the wrong side of history to say that the blessings are not secured necessarily. I think this was a really important point. And it really speaks to what happened in this election and what led to the election. You had a group of people who for many years were told that they were on the wrong side of history, that they were wrong, that the culture war was over and they had lost. And in this election, there was a bit of pushback to that. And I think that's a very significant thing. At the same time, there was still some lecturing aspects of this speech. You played the clip about how we need to think the best of other people and be generous in how we treat their opinions. And then he says something like, he suggests basically that other people don't believe in science and reason. You know,
you have to believe science and reason matter.
It's like, there's
some evidence of this, right? I mean, that's not exactly just a lecturing point, is it?
Is there, you're saying there's evidence that his political opponents don't believe in science and reason?
Yes,
I guess so.
Okay,
is that
just
laughable?
So
my impression is that there's some real significant truth in that.
Just so you're aware, that comes off very pompous to people who do not share his political views. You're dismissed as someone who simply doesn't believe in science and reason, instead of having a genuine difference of opinion.
But you've got people who come straight out and argue with science on the basis of evolutionary theories, and more than that, more actively in politics. We'll come back and look at it. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we are talking this hour about President Obama's farewell to the nation, his stirring call for the defense of democracy, and the legacy he leaves, the country, and Donald Trump. You can join us this hour. Did you watch last night? What did you hear? Can you believe Barack Obama's time as president is over? And what did you think of his characterization of the lasting impact of his years in office? With Molly Hemingway, senior editor at The Federalist, Jamelle Bouie, chief political correspondent for Slate, Jonathan Chait, New York Magazine and author of the new book, Audacity, How Barack Obama Defied His Critics and Created a Legacy That Will Prevail. Do you agree? There were those stirring congratulations to the Yes, We Can that powered his election success in the first place. Claims of accomplishment here, steering the country through the Great Recession, growing economy, reducing the rate of uninsured Americans to record lows, keeping a cap on health care costs. He said, well, the credit belongs to his supporters and the American people.
That's what you did. You were the change. You answered people's hopes. And because of you, by almost every measure, America is a better, stronger place than it was when we started.
But there were also pretty dire warnings last night, talking about the Constitution, how great it is, but it's just a piece of paper. America's not fragile, he said, but the gains of freedom are not assured.
Our Constitution is a remarkable, beautiful gift. But it's really just a piece of parchment. It has no power on its own. We the people give it power. We the people give it meaning with our participation and with the choices that we make and the alliances that we forge. Whether or not we stand up for our freedoms, whether or not we respect and enforce the rule of law, that's up to us. America's no fragile thing, but the gains of our long journey to freedom are not assured.
No fragile thing, freedom not assured. Jonathan Chait, Jamelle Bouie, Molly Hemingway, please stand by. Lots of callers here. Joyce in Omaha, Nebraska. Joyce, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
I'd like to thank our 44th president for being such a public servant. And the key to public service is the American people. He served us with dignity, grace. He was animate about the things that he wanted to do for this country, which at every turn, he was stopped in so many ways. And I agree with him about how this country must continue to fight for our rights. We are a very unique country in that we are all immigrants. Unless you're Native American, you are an immigrant in this country. So we owe each other a thanks, of gratitude. And like I said, I think he served us with dignity and grace. And what we have coming now is a big question mark when someone won't even release their own tax returns and they want to be the president of the United States.
Joyce, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. Dignity and grace. It's hard to argue on that front with Barack Obama. It's a bigger picture than that, though, I guess, when it comes to legacy. But that's big in itself. Tom in Des Moines, Iowa. Tom, you're on.
Yes. Hi, Tom. I just wanted to comment as a Barack Obama supporter. I voted for him twice. That I knew from the outset that he was going to not confront the GOP propaganda machine. And it strengthened over the course of his 8 years. And that's why truth and love should be at the basis of democracy, not hope and change. Truth has to be focused upon. It has to be pounded on. When you've got a Republican propaganda machine that is putting out all kinds of exaggeration, if not outright lies, you've got to confront them every single day with the opposite, with the truth. And Obama didn't do that. He's a politician, okay? He needs to confront the Republicans with what they're saying.
Tom, what about Molly's view that, look, there were just a lot of people in this country with a different view of the culture and the future they wanted, and those people have now stood up in the November election and elected a president very different from Barack Obama.
Yes, that's where love comes in. Okay, we have to love the people who are not like us. And we have to understand in what we aspire to as a government that half the country does not want a super big government. They're afraid of big government. And we have to understand that in our aspirations. We have to say, okay, until we can convince people to have more government doing more things, we have to dial back our ambitions, okay, in the immediate term, okay. Ultimately, we can still say we want government to provide for the needs of the people on the long term, but we have to go incrementally.
Tom, let us pick it up. Jamelle Bouie, there Barack Obama gets credit for dignity, for grace. There's kind of eloquence that's hard to deny, but Tom looks at it out of Iowa and says, hey, he did not fight hard enough, and he lost ground for his own view during his presidency.
I think part of the trouble here in trying to determine whether or not Obama fought hard enough or not is that our view of political power is a bit too focused individually. And so it's certainly true that Barack Obama did not make headway, as much headway as he would have liked. It's certainly true that there are places where Barack Obama dropped the ball, where there are fights he could have fought but that he didn't. But it's also true that through the 8 years of his presidency, or at least through 6 years of his presidency, he dealt with a divided Congress and a Republican minority and later majority, or House majority, later majority of both chambers, that had a pretty implacable opposition to his agenda across many areas. And so under that circumstance, it's sort of hard to imagine the president who wouldn't in some sense be disappointing. Even Lyndon Johnson would not have been very successful if he was dealing with an opposing majority that wanted nothing to do with his agenda. And so I think just sort of like when evaluating Obama in this regard, we have to take care to look at the broader circumstances under which his presidency took place, and to not fall into the trap of thinking that the weaknesses of the Obama presidency are purely a function of Obama's personal characteristics. Quite a bit of this reflects political, institutional, and structural features of our political world.
Molly Hemingway, how do you look at that? I'll come to you in just a second, Jonathan. How do you look at the legacy of this man, this president, as he, well, in just 10 days, less than that now, prepares to leave office, Molly?
Well, that's such a big question. I was actually just reflecting on the caller talking about going against the Republican propaganda machine. And I absolutely agree that we are in a very dangerous era of post-truth politics where people say things. We've elected a president who you cannot take him at his word, and that is a deeply troubling and problematic thing.
You're talking to Mr.
At the same
Trump.
Time, yes, mm-hmm. sorry. Mm-hmm. At the same time, we had problems with that under our current president as well. And I think that people underestimate the significance of what it felt like to have a president tell you that if you like your health care plan, you can keep your health care plan and have that rated as true by media fact checkers and only to have what we all, you know happened, or have, you know, Ben Rhodes in the White House office admit that they created an echo chamber to push through the Iran deal, or that we knew that it was an al-Qaeda terrorist attack that assassinated our ambassador in Libya and killed three other Americans, but we put out a narrative that it was about a video and whatnot. There was all sorts of shading of truth that helped create an environment where someone like Donald Trump could rise, and I think that you have to take responsibility for that. As far as the larger legacy, again, I think that one of the things that's striking about the speech, which sounded so much like a speech we've heard before over and over again, is how after 8 years, so many of Obama's accomplishments, whether real or symbolic, they appear to be fleeting. You know, there will be massive changes to Obamacare one way or the other. The Iran deal might be revised. And just all the hope that people had about the direction of the country, or fear that they had about the direction of the country under Obama, all of that seems to be fleeting. That's not, again, as far as the legacy, I think there are many questions about U.S.'s position globally and how we have handled ourselves for the last 8 years. It's actually my biggest disappointment with Obama. I really liked how he talked about the role of America in the world 8 years ago. I think, unfortunately, he put people into positions where they could not accomplish his foreign policy vision, and in frequent cases were actually fighting against it. You know, take what Hillary Clinton's different view of what we should be doing in Libya or whatnot, very different from what President Obama came to office sounding like he would want to do. But the foreign policy is a big one.
Jonathan Chait, you make just the opposite argument when it comes to his legacy. You say that it was big, broad, and it will last. You say both the right and left underestimate what will last. Make the case, Jonathan.
Right. So my book is sort of written for those two callers, because that's a huge chunk of the Obama vote, people who thought he tried to do a lot of good things, but the Republicans stopped him. And what I'm trying to show in this book is he tried to do a lot of big things and he succeeded. He didn't get everything he wanted done, but he did an awful lot in historical context. And it's also true that most of what he did is going to last. Some of it will be rolled back, but we don't know how much, and I think people are dramatically overestimating how vulnerable his legacy is.
Make the case for much what he succeeded certainly. In and what will last, in your view.
Well, he did an awful lot, and I don't have time to get into every single thing, but start with the economic recovery, right? There was the stimulus, there was the bank rescue, there was the auto bailout, all done against the implacable opposition of the Republican Party, done nonetheless, and prevented a new Great Depression. They're not going to go back in time and bring back that economic crisis that he prevented from having. Obamacare is proving much, much more difficult for Republicans to get rid of than they thought, because there are people who are enjoying these programs, and many of them voted for Trump and expect Trump to protect their care. And Republicans have figured this out, and they're running into serious difficulties taking it away. So I think they may tweak the program and try to call it repeal and replace. It's possible they'll pull away the whole thing, but they'll be provoking an enormous backlash, of which Republicans are already terrified.
Jesse,
on climate.
Oh, yes, please go ahead.
Climate change. The cost of green energy has plummeted 50%, 75% in these technologies, and it's dramatically overtaking old technologies in all these facets of of energy use and green energy sectors, coal is being displaced in a way that will be impossible for Trump to reverse. And the diplomatic agreements that Trump put into place have created that Obama put into place have created a momentum of their own that Trump is going to have a hard time overturning, despite his denial of the findings of climate science. He may slow down the green energy revolution that Obama started with his investments in green energy and his regulatory agenda, but he's not going to stop it. And he's certainly not going to be able to roll it back. He's not going to be able, he doesn't have the votes to undo Dodd-Frank, which completely restructured Wall Street. He's not going to undo the changes in education reform that were unleashed by Race to the Top, and on and on. He's going to do some things. He's going to cut taxes for the rich after Obama raised them. He's going to stop enforcing a lot of laws that they don't like, which any Republican administration does. Any Republican administration is going to stop or slow down its enforcement of labor law, of campaign finance law, of laws on Wall Street. But these laws are going to stay in place, and the legacy is going to be there for a long time.
Jamal, are you so confident of the durability of President Obama's accomplishments?
I'm actually quite indecisive on this, because I do find John's argument here pretty persuasive, but I tend towards like a basic pessimism about things, and so I suspect that a bit more than John thinks may get dismantled. But this, he is right that the current situation with the Affordable Care Act, that the hesitancy which Republican senators in particular have with regards to repeal does suggest that this is a bit more durable than we think. My worries tend less towards concrete programs or elements of the Obama legacy being dismantled, and more towards what a successful Trump presidency may do to our politics and what it might reify after 50 years of really getting away from a kind of explicit racial and nativist prejudice in politics. I think a successful Trump presidency may bring that back into the fore. And that, I mean, that to me would be the most ironic repudiation of Obama's legacy, that a president who kind of embodies a commitment to multiracial, multiethnic democracy being succeeded by one who very much does not.
Interesting last night that maybe the biggest applause line of the night, or one of the biggest, was when he said Obama said, "I reject discrimination against Muslim Americans." And that simple statement brought the crowd to its feet and a huge amount of applause. But yes, you have a kind of, what do you call it, racial nativist prejudice that Donald Trump has dealt in. And it's elicited quite a response. Jesse in Charlotte, North Carolina. Jesse, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. I just wanted to mention, as a Republican, that I think that President Obama, while I don't agree with a lot of his stuff politically, that he's done a good by his party, by the Democratic Party, and I hope that the president, you know, that Trump can do the same, that he can bring in the same values and really stick by our party the way that President Obama has, and for that I respect him.
But
I do have to touch on, though, real mm-hmm. quick about something that was mentioned about reason and science, and that is so as people, I don't see how we can disclaim, because you say reason and science, well, that brings God into the picture, and for people's beliefs, if I believe in an all-powerful God, then I don't have to believe in evolution. Now, I do believe in evolution as a person, but I can't say that somebody else shouldn't be able to, because if they believe in an all-powerful God, then that God could put those things in place with the snap of his fingers.
Do you see a president who calls for science and reason as an attack on religion, on your belief, on you, Jesse?
Well, maybe not so much as an attack, maybe, but I mean, as somebody that knows plenty of people that do believe in an all-powerful God, I could see that being an attack on them. I could see them looking at it that way. Me personally, I believe in evolution. I believe, you know, I still believe in God. You know, I'm a, you know, a Christian male. I believe that we do have an all-powerful God, and if he wanted to do that, he could. But I also believe that he has brought this world around in a way that is sensible, and you know, that I don't question, you know, his motives or his meaning. But
Jesse, I appreciate your call. We got to take a short break here. Science, reason, God. Jesse in Charlotte, North Carolina there, and the legacy of Barack Obama on the table today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for On Point and the following message comes from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. When it comes to the big decision of choosing a mortgage lender, work with one that has your best interests in mind. Rocket Mortgage provides a transparent online process that helps you understand all the details of your home loan. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the right mortgage solution for you. Skip the bank, skip the waiting, and go completely online at quickenloans.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, and we're talking this hour about President Obama's farewell to the nation from Chicago last night and the legacy of his 8 years as President of the United States, 44th President of the United States. Jonathan Chait is with us off the new book, Audacity, How Barack Obama Defied His Critics and Created a Legacy That Will Prevail, Jonathan writes. Jamelle Bouie's here, Chief Political Correspondent for Slate. Senior editor at The Federalist, Molly Hemingway, is here, not so keen on that legacy. You can join us as well. Did the country end up more divided after all those 8 years? Why, if that's the case? Will you miss Barack Obama, his poise, his eloquence, his family, his scandal-free years? For all that, is his legacy Donald Trump? How will you remember President Barack Obama? He came out last night swinging on a couple of fronts, saying, look, if we want this democracy to be strong, we've got to take care of it. And he had some tough questions here. Here he was on voting and America and how we treat it.
When voting rates in America are some of the lowest among advanced democracies, we should be making it easier, not harder, to vote.
And then on drawing districts for voting and trust in our institutions.
When trust in our institutions is low, we should reduce the corrosive influence of money in our politics and insist on the principles of transparency and ethics in public service. When Congress is dysfunctional, we should draw our congressional districts to encourage politicians to cater to common sense and not rigid extremes.
And then let's not just become another big power without values or American values, he was suggesting, like Russia or China.
Rivals like Russia or China cannot match our influence around the world unless we give up what we stand for and turn ourselves into just another big country that bullies smaller neighbors.
Jonathan Chait, there was a pretty strong bill of particulars there. I mean, you can argue, you can debate it, but he was going right at things that have become facts in our country that are undercutting, he said, our democracy and our values.
Right. He was analyzing Trump's political style. He was analyzing the populism, the nationalism, the distrust of science and reason. Just the other day, Trump apparently met with Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who's an anti-vaccine kook, which further underscores his contempt for science, which is most closely associated with his denial of climate science. A lot of these trends have been part of right-wing politics for a very, very, very long time. You can go back to Charles Coughlin, to Joe McCarthy, to Wallace. But what's happened under Trump is that this paranoid right-wing political style has finally gained complete control of a political party, and with it gained the powers of the presidency. So in that sense, we're entering a frightening period.
But does that have to lie at the doorstep of Barack Obama in no small part? I mean, Jamelle talked about the structural obstacles to success in some fronts in Obama's terms that he faced. Right. Okay, fair enough. Nevertheless, here we are. 8 years is a long time, and hope and change was the theme. You're critical of Donald Trump and his political style, but that's what's coming in. How much of that rests on Barack Obama's shoulders?
Yeah. So when you assess Abe Lincoln's legacy, and I'm not comparing them, but I'm using him because he's agreed by many rightly to be the best president in American history. Do you say a big part of his legacy was Andrew Johnson? Because Andrew Johnson was the worst president in American history. And Andrew Johnson came directly after Lincoln. And not only did he come after Lincoln made him president by removing his vice president and putting Andrew Johnson on his ticket. But we don't say that Andrew Johnson is Abraham Lincoln's legacy. We assess Lincoln's legacy by looking at what Lincoln did, even though I think actually picking Andrew Johnson was one of the biggest mistakes any president has made in American history. So to blame Obama for a president who succeeded him, who he didn't pick, I think is not the normal way we assess presidents' legacies, and I don't think it's the right way to assess a president's legacy.
Let's get a call from Texas, Justin in Alpine, Texas. Justin, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, sir. Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Okay. What do you see?
Well, I don't like the man. I really never have. It's hard to even watch him on television. I think from what I watched a little bit last night is, he's a very divisive president. We never had this many problems as far as race and all that. I know there was a lot in the past, but it just seems like it's all just blown up again in the last 8 years. And what I heard on his farewell speech last night was just more divisiveness.
Justin, pin that down, because he's always saying the words of unity. He's always talking about coming together. Yeah. I mean, last night he specifically said to, I think it was addressed to African Americans and other minorities, that we all have to consider what it's like to be in the other guy's shoes. Even he said, I think that middle-aged white guy whose career is unstable. I mean, you could hardly be more explicit in reaching out than that. But so, what do you find divisive, Justin?
Well, yes, sir, but I understand what's coming out of his mouth, but his actions are totally different. Especially with the Police Officers Association, hardly any account has been paid to them, but yet you invite Black Lives Matter people to the White House and, just throw a big old ball party for them. It's just the same type of deal. Just attacks, 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 and then go on TV, happy, happy, joy, joy, let's smile, and everybody needs to come together. He just had dig after dig to Trump last night, as far as the Rio Grande, which insinuates the wall, science, which insinuates, an attack on global warming. It's all
but there. But Trump has attacked global warming. I mean, he once called it a Chinese hoax.
Well, yeah, that deal is up for debate. There's been ups and downs all through history. When polar ice caps have melted, and then you get more snow than you know what to do with, and then you're up and down. So to me, that's still open for discussion.
Justin, we've got it. I appreciate your call. Jamel, what about this notion from Justin in Texas of Barack Obama as the great divider? I mean, you may or may not agree with his argument, but there clearly is division.
There is division. I think I would question the notion that there is an unprecedented amount of racial division in the country, certainly not compared to 50 years ago in the 1960s, not even compared to 40 years ago in the 1970s when there were riots over busing in Boston, for example. I think what Justin may be missing is the extent to which racial inequality and racial discrimination in housing and jobs and in criminal justice are still enduring parts of the American landscape. So what he may perceive as division, to me at least, is more people who are suffering from that discrimination in housing, jobs, and criminal justice saying something about it, engaging democratically in a way to change their situation. And I see nothing troubling or disturbing about that. I should also add that just last year, in April of 2016, President Obama – or May of 2016, my mistake – President Obama invited 13 police officers to the White House to award them with the Medal of Valor.
Yeah.
And so the idea that Obama has been hostile towards police officers – I watched him speak at the funeral of the officer killed in Dallas, I believe – where he was effusive in his praise for the nation's law enforcement and has always been. the idea that Obama is somehow hostile to police officers, I just don't think fits the facts. That Obama is also sympathetic to the claims of a protest movement that wants to reduce violence against Black Americans in the criminal justice system, that he's sympathetic to that group, I don't think is evidence of some sort of antipathy towards law enforcement. So that's I think it's worth saying that as well. The last thing I'd add is that to talk about division, racial division in the Obama era, and talk about it as a function of Obama doing something to stoke it, I think misreads what we know about it. So there's a great book by a political scientist named Michael Tesler who looks at the rapid racialization of politics across many different fields that begins with Obama's election. And so really before Obama even begins to do anything, you see racial attitudes becoming determinative of a wider variety of political attitudes. And you can see – I mean really you can see in the person of Donald Trump the extent to which there was a racialized reaction that was independent of anything Obama did. Remember, Trump's rise in the political scene wasn't as a crusader for better trade deals. It was as someone who questioned the authenticity of Obama's birth certificate. He questioned his legitimacy as president, and he did so without any cause or evidence. It was purely an argument that Obama appeared to be other, therefore could not really be the legitimate president of the United States. And so that as well is part of this story of division and of racial conflict in the Obama era.
Molly, I want to ask you about a reference in his speech last night to I think what you could describe as a surprising evolution during his years in challenges from abroad. Obama talked about the post-World War II order that was built with other democracies, challenges to that, which he said had come from violent fanatics who claimed to speak for Islam, but now, he said, from autocrats in foreign capitals.
That order is now being challenged. First, by violent fanatics who claim to speak for Islam. More recently, by autocrats in foreign capitals who see free markets and open democracies and civil society itself as a threat to their power.
Now, Molly, maybe Jonathan would put this in the camp of another jab at Donald Trump, especially, you know, all this was happening as last night tumbling out were all these unverified allegations about the Trump connections to Moscow. But here we are, the president warning not just about radical Islam, which he and other presidents have grappled with. He talked about the killing of Osama bin Laden during his time in office. But this sort of surprising challenge from autocrats, does that resonate with you?
So this is one of the things that's so frustrating about the current hysteria where people are trying to delegitimize the democratic election that we just had and say that Russia controlled the outcome of the election. The last 8 years saw President Obama not treating Russia like the threat that it is and was, or that just the strong adversary it is. And he, of course, you know, remember he said he was going to have more flexibility after his reelection and how to deal with Russia. We mocked Mitt Romney for saying that Russia was our biggest geopolitical threat during the second term. We're to believe that Russia was just playing fast and loose with our electoral process, meddling here and there. And we didn't do anything at all. Whatsoever. Until after the election, now we're making a big deal about it. It is so frustrating that President Obama didn't do what he could have done during his time in office to actually deal with this threat, that he sort of let Russia rise, that he didn't do anything when they took Crimea.
But does that undercut his argument?
That he's let them play around in Syria, that he himself showed such moral cowardice on the Syria question, saying that if they crossed a red line, it would be bad, and then nothing ever happened, and Russia is
totally
dominating. I take
that, but does that undercut the argument that now we have this kind of challenge from autocrats? I mean, Donald Trump is talking about being best buddies with Moscow, and it is clear, whatever you think of the allegations of interference in the U.S. election, that all the U.S. intelligence services have said they believe happened, and then this latest stuff, I don't know what to make of that, but it is pretty wild. It's clear that Vladimir Putin is not exactly a promoter of democracy and Western values, and he's pushing big time, and Donald Trump's prepared to work with him. Is President Obama wrong to point that out?
It's just so political that it's hard to take it seriously at this point. And it's doing – if you believe, as I do, that the whole point of Russian meddling is to undermine our foundations of democracy and to make us lose confidence in our institutions, I think the Obama administration's response and the current intelligence community's practice of leaking is doing so much more to help Russia accomplish that goal than the actual Russian acts themselves. Like the actual
I'm not following the logic there. We've had an election and we've got this outcome and now we're living with it. But I'll just let it stand right there. One more. Albuquerque, New Mexico. Monica, you're on the air.
I just wanted to make a comment that I'm a registered Republican. I'm not a supporter of Obama, but I do want to thank him for representing our country with grace and class, and I'm afraid that's something that we're not going to see with this new president.
I appreciate your call, Monica, from Albuquerque. Thank you very much for that. Jonathan Chait, off he goes. People were saying, you know, as he walked off stage last night, there's a whole lot walking off with him. You say his legacy is strong, but we are headed into a very different presidency right now. How do you see the legacy first running in to the new authority in the White House coming January 20th?
I don't think the right way to think about it is that Obama's legacy is primarily being threatened, although it is. But I think the way to think about it is that the legacy of all 44 presidents in American history is being threatened, because you have someone who worships power and has praised authoritarians and is surrounded by a party that is indulging his violation of governing norms almost without limit, as far as we can tell. And so, which poses a threat to the system of government that has been built up for more than 200 years. So all, the entire American political democratic legacy is what's being threatened primarily, and Obama's policies only incidentally.
Where will he rank when historians look back? Top third, middle third, bottom third? Where do you think, Jonathan?
Top third, absolutely.
Jamel?
I would say top third as well.
Molly?
I always decline until you get a little bit of perspective, but I don't see any – definitely not the top third.
And I mean, there's only like 45. So, I mean, if you're doing bottom third, you're looking at your Johnsons and your Hardings and such. And so at least middle third, I think it's fair.
Okay. We got top, middle, and abstention there. But a remarkable man, I think, by all accounts. Whatever you think of his leadership and the results in these last few years, I think Monica, in our Republican in Albuquerque, gets it right. A lot of grace there, and years largely untainted by scandal, which has been a pleasure in itself. I want to thank all three of you for being with us today. Molly Hemingway at The Federalist, thank you for being here today, Molly.
Thank you.
Jamel Bowie at Slate, thanks a lot for joining us, Jamel.
Thank you.
And Jonathan Chait at New York Magazine, author of Audacity. Thank you very much for being here today, Jonathan.
Thanks, I enjoyed it.
And there goes Barack Obama, 44th president of the United States. Inauguration Day is on its way. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.